Good morning, everyone. On behalf of Wikimedia District of Columbia, I would like to welcome all of you to Wikimania 2012. I would like to thank our partners and collaborators, the U.S. Department of State Office of Media Diplomacy, the Library of Congress, the Wikimedia Foundation, Wikimedia Deutschland, the National Archives and Records Administration, OpenHatch, and the Broadcasting Board of Governors for working with us to make this conference possible. I would also like to thank our sponsors, Google, Ask.com, Zoom, the Encyclopedia of Life, the Richard Lounsbery Foundation, Wikia, the Sailor Foundation, and WikiHow for their generous contributions. Finally, I would like to thank our incredible conference organizing team, which has been working in one way or another since January 22, 2011, to make this conference possible. Nicholas Bashore, Katie Filbert, Tiffany Smith, Ursula Guillemes, Doror Lynn, Sage Ross, Chad Moraho, and our legion of volunteers, all led by Danny B. Yeah! I would also like to point out that during this conference, there will be many side events taking place during the evening. Tonight, we have Glam Night Out at the museum and the official Wikimania Happy Hour, sponsored by Zoom at Tonic. Check out the information desk on the third floor of the Marvin Center if you'd like to learn more about our side events. I'm glad you could join us this morning with this excellent weather. You see, I edited the Wikipedia article on DC summers to say that we don't have 100 degree heat waves, and apparently it worked. If you have attended a previous Wikimania, welcome back. If this is your first Wikimania, I'd like to introduce you to the events of the next few days. Wikimania is where you go to meet the people who work on Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia, which is maintained by volunteers and operated by the Wikimedia Foundation. That's Wikimedia with an M. The Wikimedia Foundation is a non-profit organization that runs Wikipedia, Wiktionary, Wikiquote, Wikibooks, Wikisource, Wikinews, Wikiversity, Wikispecies, the MediaWiki Software Project, Wikimedia Commons, and I'd like to introduce our latest project under development, Wikidata. Yeah. Volunteers for all these projects and more will be here today discussing their latest findings and pondering the future of the Wikimedia project. It is going to be an exciting 4 days. But first, I would like to introduce our first speaker, Don Nunziato. Professor Nunziato is an internationally recognized expert in the area of free speech and the internet. Her primary teaching and scholarship interests are in the areas of internet law, free speech, and digital copyright. She recently published her book, Virtual Freedom, Net Neutrality, and Free Speech in the Internet Age, and has lectured and written extensively on issues involving free speech and the internet. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Don Nunziato.
Good morning, and thank you for that kind welcome. On behalf of GW Law School, I'd like to welcome you all to our listener auditorium. It's a great honor for GW Law School to partner with the Department of State on important and exciting events like this one. And GW Law School, under our relatively new dean, Paul Berman, has been particularly committed to bridging the gap between the ivory tower of academia and the real world of law and policy and practice. We're particularly committed to capitalizing on our location in the nation's capital and are very honored to sponsor and support events like this. As was said, at GW Law, professors like myself are particularly focused on cyber law issues. I teach in the area of internet law, digital copyright, and free speech. And toward that end, with Microsoft's generous support, my colleague Arturo Carrillo and I created a program and a speaker series on global internet freedom and human rights. I'm very excited to be sponsoring a number of speakers in connection with that speaker series. Vince Cerf is going to come and speak to us in a couple of months. Ai Weiwei, Chinese human rights activist, is hopefully going to be let out of China to come speak to us on global internet freedom issues. We sponsored Rebecca McKinnon, the author of Consent of the Network and an internet free speech activist last year as part of the Distinguished Speaker Series, so we're really excited about that. GW Law was recently chosen to be the new home of the Federal Communications Law Journal. We look forward to working with the Federal Communications Bar here in DC on cutting edge issues of communications law. And in connection with that, FCC Chairman Janikowski is going to come to speak to us to launch that new journal in a few months. So we're very active on these types of issues, and we're very excited to be sponsoring and supporting events like these. I'm also very proud of the work of my colleagues Dan Solov and Oren Kerr, who you may be familiar with, who are leaders in the areas of internet privacy and cybercrime. So we got a lot going on here at GW Law. And in particular, our new dean, Paul Berman, is a world-renowned expert in internet law issues and the author of a well-regarded casebook on the subject. So once again, welcome to all of you, and on with the show.
At Wikimania, we have the great privilege of working with the U.S. Department of State for our Tech Estate track. Our next speaker, Richard Boley, is a career U.S. diplomat and the current director of the Office of E-Diplomacy, an applied technology think tank for the U.S. Department of State. Previously, he was a National Security Affairs Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, where he launched the Global Entrepreneurship Program. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Boley.
Good morning, Wikipedians and Wikimedians! My name is Richard Boley, and I am part of the Office of E-Diplomacy at the State Department. Despite the suit, we feel that we are kindred spirits with you. Actually, I would like to ask all the people from E-Diplomacy here to stand up briefly. Just stand up, so you can search them out and find out more about what we're doing. We're so excited to be able to partner with you and with GW Law School, and we will have, as part of our Tech Estate track, some really interesting presentations which dovetail perfectly with the conference. One of the best known platforms that we have, or products that we offer in e-diplomacy, our Tech Estate, this quarterly conference on the convergence of technology, foreign policy, and development, and the other is Diplopedia, built on MediaWiki. And you'll get a chance tomorrow morning to hear from Tiffany Smith and Chris Bromp, who will be talking about that as part of the Tech Estate track. I also wanted to give a shout out to Tim Hayes, who has been curating these Tech Estates, and I think he's still over at the Martin Center checking people in, but Tim has been a huge driver in making this collaboration possible. But really, my goal here is to bring the words of our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. Secretary of State would have loved to have been here, but unfortunately is traveling, and she did pen a letter that she asked me to share with you. And we will scan the signed letter and make it available, obviously, on the Wiki website. So here goes. Dear friends, on behalf of the U.S. Department of State, I am delighted to extend my heartfelt congratulations on the opening of Wikimania 2012 and the Tech Estate, wiki.gov. I commend each of you for your dedication to enhancing global understanding through the many projects and initiatives that the Wikimedia Foundation supports. Wikimania 2012 highlights the intersection of government and community goals. It demonstrates how we are breaking down the barriers between governments and the citizens they serve by making readily available critical information that is often difficult to find. The U.S. Department of State supports these endeavors in technology, knowledge sharing, and community building, as they are important pillars of our 21st century statecraft agenda. I am a staunch advocate of bringing technology and knowledge to citizens around the world. And I believe it is vitally important that our diplomats understand the huge potential of using connection technologies as a way to reach foreign audiences. The world is more connected now than ever before, but there is still much work to be done to fully capitalize on the potential of this interconnection. There are many people who are disenfranchised because they lack access to information. There are others whose contribution would make our collective knowledge richer, but they face risks and difficulties in doing so. Your work and the Wikimedia Foundation contributes greatly to achieving our shared goal of making information more open and accessible. Thank you for your efforts, and please know you have my best wishes for a productive and enjoyable Wikimedia 2012. With appreciation and best regards, I am sincerely yours, signed Hillary Rodham Clinton. Thank you. Now, I would like to introduce our keynote speaker for Wikimania 2012, Mary Gardner. She is an open source developer, computer science graduate student, and women in open source advocate with over 10 years of experience. Mary's research is in lexical semantics and concentrates on how changes in word choice can affect meaning and tone. Before entering graduate school, she worked as a senior software engineer for a year and contributed code to the Python-based Twisted project. In 2011, she co-founded the ADA Initiative, supporting women in open technology culture. Ladies and gentlemen, Mary Gardner.
Good morning, Wikimanians. Good morning, Ticket State attendees.
Morning.
So, as interesting as computational lexical semantics and computational sentiment analysis are, I'm not going to talk about my PhD work today. I'm talking about my new project, the ADA Initiative, which is a US-based nonprofit supporting women in open technology and culture, which very much includes wiki projects and other open knowledge projects, also open source, remix culture, open government, open data projects, and similar. And what I'm going to talk about specifically is fostering diversity in these kind of projects broadly, not only the gender diversity, but diversity across different economic backgrounds, different geographic origins, different ethnic origins, and so on. So I subtitled my talk, maybe in a slightly inflammatory way, I wrote, not a boring chore, a critical opportunity, because there can be this temptation, hopefully not succumb to too much within this room, to view diversity as essentially a PR exercise that a more diverse project looks better. It is, however, of course, crucial in a project with a mission like that of Wikipedia and other Wikimedia projects to encompass in the case of Wikipedia, an encyclopedia covering the sum of human knowledge, ultimately. Obviously, to incorporate the sum of human knowledge, you need to incorporate the sum of humans in some crucial way. So, it should be fairly obvious that, therefore, diversity is one of the key goals of Wikimedia projects. Okay, so first of all, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Wiki projects as social change. It's not what everyone involved in Wiki projects is aiming for. There are different reasons that you want to build the sum of human knowledge, and creating social change is only one of them. But it is something that happens as you build these projects and make them freely available that things change both because of the project and with the momentum of the project. So just quick, as a very narrow example, this is from Joseph Riegel's keynote last year. He mentioned the Ardwolf article back in 2001 on Wikipedia, back when each Wikipedia title had to contain at least two capital letters, which is why it's Ardwolf and capital F, and South Africa. Yes, still has a terminal A and so forth. Anyway, so apparently the article read in total, Ardwolf, small animal from South Africa related to the hyena, lives in the ground, nocturnal hunter. And now you have the typical Wikipedia zoological article with zoological classification, behavior characteristics, geographic distribution, and so on. So, yeah, that's not social change, that's Wikipedia changing. Stepping out to one particular individual. That's me when I was 14 years old. The reason this is not the most flattering photo of me at 14 years old, even I was pretty sort of awkward and gawky and so on, but it's not the most flattering photo, and the reason is that I asked my father to scan these, and this was the most flattering photo of the ones he saw. So the Wikipedia-related point here is that, I mean, I was a pretty nerdy teenager. I would be about 14. For my 14th birthday, I got a reference work for my birthday. It was the Penguin Book of Curious and Interesting Numbers. It goes from minus one up to Graham's number, skipping some numbers in between. And I read it in numerical order. And this is a person who really needed Wikipedia, but it didn't exist. Okay, so now, that person, when I wrote these slides, these were the last 15 or so Wikipedia pages that showed up in my browser history, skipping all the articles I read on individual members of the video. So that's not social change. I mean, that's social change in that it affected me, but it's important to note that, I am in my early 30s, I've been taken from this thing of, having my one book, my one precious book of numbers that I read to death, through to being able to read about colorectal cancer and Team Mobile USA in the same 2-day period. Okay. Again, social change that Wikipedians are very familiar with. In 1990, Encyclopedia Britannica had their highest sales volume before or since of 120,000 printed copies of the encyclopedia. I never had one. I spent most of my, maybe not when I was 14, but I spent most of my preteen years wishing that I did. Okay, well, a couple of years ago, as you know, they sold around 8,500 copies and they closed their printed edition down, and they did report that they had 450 million visits to their website. That does include the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Okay, way back in 2006, practically prehistory, 18% of the world's population is using the internet. Only 3% of the two continents listed here are the two smallest percentages reported on that Wikipedia page that I'm using as a reference. I'm told you're not meant to do that. I'm not sure if that's true in this crowd. 3% of the African population is using the internet, and 11% of the Asian Pacific population is using the internet. Okay, again, using Wikipedia as a reference, 35% of the world's population using the internet, 13% of the African population, four times increase, 27% of the Asian Pacific population, more than doubled, using the internet. So here we have really social change. Encyclopedia Britannica has gone away, and 35% of the world's population is using the internet. So this is the kind of story that, as you know, Wikimedia projects are part of, the mooted, at least, print, open access, ebooks, ultimately the internet. Okay, so we get to the topic of diversity and how that relates. So the good news with Wikipedia is that, as internet projects go, very diverse project along many dimensions. At the end of May, there were 285 Wikipedias, 4 of them, had over 1 million articles, 40 including the period that fall, English, German, French, and Dutch, I think, in the fall, had 100,000 articles, 112 have at least 10,000 articles. So that's 112 different languages you can read 10,000 articles about human knowledge in. That's extremely diverse. There are, of course, somewhere between, it depends how well you define as a language, somewhere between 3,000 and 8,000 languages spoken worldwide, of which the vast majority have no written form, but maybe ultimately that won't stop Wikimedia projects. But I'm not here today to argue that there's a linguistic diversity problem, at least as compared to your competitors. A great number of diverse countries represented here: Poland, the Czech Republic, China, the USA, Russia, and so on. India is in there, although as a share of its world population is vastly underrepresented. Okay, so the less good news, again, as many people here will know, is that about a third of Wikipedia readers who responded to the survey reported being women. And the even less good news is that less than slightly less than a tenth of the editors reported being women, despite women comprising 51% of the world population. Which, you know, one is inclined to suspect that there is a link, that if women are not using Wikipedia, if they're not finding it useful in the same numbers that men do, they find it even less interesting to contribute to. So in addition to other factors, the usefulness and representativeness of the knowledge contained within Wikimedia projects will affect the willingness of diverse people to contribute to them. Okay, so having made this argument that Wikimedia projects are part of social change, whether or not Wikimedia projects are always intending to drive social change, they are in some way part of social change, and sometimes they are intending to be part of driving social change and giving people like my 14-year-old self more information about colorectal cancer. I want to talk a little bit about the general principles of diversity. So if you want to increase diversity in a project, why do you want to do that? And then a little bit about how. Okay, so there's a term used a little bit in some of the literature about instrumental diversity in particular. So instrumental diversity is essentially, in this context, the question of how can diverse participation make Wikimedia projects better? So the argument would be that we have, you know, people with different perspectives, different knowledges coming in, their knowledge might make Wikipedia more comprehensive, more representative, and so on. Okay, that's instrumental because you're primarily arguing for diversity in order to benefit Wikipedia rather than the other way around. You can argue the other way around, that a more representative Wikimedia project with knowledge that's relevant to more people will benefit those people. So at the extreme end, the instrumental argument is sort of the PR argument, you know, it makes us sort of, like, that is one of the instrumental arguments. It makes us look better to have diversity, and so that will assist us, but also, you know, it makes the actual product better. And you have to balance these arguments. You can't think entirely in terms of instrumental diversity because it's not fair to the people who you're asking to give to you. There has to be an exchange where, in order to ask people to make the Wikimedia project better, there has to be some way that the Wikimedia projects are planning to make to serve those people. Yes, all right. So we have here one of the slightly more difficult things to accept about diversity. So this slogan, "Nothing About Us Without Us," comes out of the disability activism community, which in turn, I believe, adopted it from the foreign affairs community, actually. And so what this is essentially that you cannot dictate to people with a particular how we're making things better for you. You know, this is for your good. We have done this. If you choose not to accept it, then you are being ungrateful and diversity is no longer our problem, it is yours. So this is difficult, right? Because you have sort of a vicious cycle. Like, well, you don't have any people of such, you know, from a certain background participating. But then there's nobody to ask how they participate, so then you end up sort of spinning your wheels. So the question then is outreach, that you simply have to identify diversity failings and you have to reach out to people and essentially keep the project, keep the discussion open to criticism, which says, you know, this would make it easier for you to participate. This would make it beneficial for you to participate. Constantly asking responses and believing them. Okay. So, talking just quickly a little more about the rationale for diversity. In the Western philosophical, the liberal philosophical tradition, the traditional argument is that it promotes oneness and harmony, essentially, that as people talk more, we will convert on one point of view and converge on perhaps one culture and one way of thinking. As I expect you know, that's not a very popular view at present. Contemporary argument is that it enables all people to change and grow, to integrate, like contact between diverse peoples allows them to borrow from each other while continuing to maintain some of their differences, both in points of view and in cultural traditions and so on. So very quickly, an example of this discussed by Peter Emberley in a 2011 book chapter is two Indian art cultures that are both affiliated with religious practice. The Dhokhara of India are sculptors, traditionally, sculpting divine forms. And Emberley argues that as they have had more contact with Western culture in particular, that their art forms, especially in the younger years, in the younger artists, while continuing to maintain artist-driven, culture-driven integrity to themselves, you know, moving away from divine forms to secular forms, moving into sometimes 2D representations rather than 3D representations, but at the same time not moving towards actually producing Western art. Likewise, the Bor people, who are Bengali, musicians, and Emberley argues in their in the music produced by their younger people now, there's starting to move again towards some representation of less eternal, more ephemeral aspects of human experience. They're also utilizing things like musical notation, musical recordings, anthropological recordings of their own culture in order to maintain it, but at the same time, viewing themselves as continuing in their own traditions, integrating the aspects of Western modernity that they can use, but without moving energy towards a more mainstream Indian or a more Anglo style of music, but allowing them to access the audience through modern means. So in terms of Wikimedia projects, you may have the same effect where part of the contribution of Wikimedia projects in documenting the sum of human knowledge is allowing people to preserve their own traditions and ways of thinking for themselves, rather than necessarily only benefiting me as a person who wants to learn more about it or not. Okay, I wanted to talk, so one of the questions, this has been very abstract so far, you're like, okay, well, what do we do if we want to recruit diverse peoples? And I just wanted to talk about some general principles there. The first is, so Sue Gardner has mentioned this, I believe, in conversations and various things, it's the power of invitation is one way of talking about it. So there's a story about this that I know really fairly well. In 2006, the Gnome Free Desktop Project, they ran the Google Summer of Code. So it's a programming project. They wanted to do the Google Summer of Code, invites university students to spend their summer working on the project with a paid lead stipend. They got 200-ish applications and there were zero from them, you know, zero people. So two known developers, Chris Ball and Helen Wallach, created what they called the Known Women's Outrage Project, which was almost, except they paid slightly less money, almost identical to the Google Summer of Code, except that it was the Known Women's Outrage Project. They received 186 applications, I believe, all of them from women. And then there was some question about, okay, why didn't they apply for the other one, which was the same, except for paying slightly more money and maybe being more prestigious in that you were selected from Whitefield. And the answer seems to be somewhere between two things. So you have a picture of a woman computing student, you have a picture of, you read a thing that says, spend your summer working on a coding project. You have a picture in your head that is not necessarily of you working all summer on a coding project. It's usually of that guy, the one who you think of is spending all this time in front of a computer. And so by saying four women, like the picture automatically changes. Like, well, you know, I'm the woman in my classes who spends all the time in front of a computer. The other thing, though, is that they discovered that other women were really, really keen, other computer science professors in this case, women who teach computer science, were really keen to do outreach for them once they had explicitly said that this was for women, it welcomed women, it was ordered to promote women. Women computer scientists, were supporting each other, and you know, some of them encouraged 10 or 15 of their own students to apply. So you had this double effect of encouraging people who specifically want, tapping into networks of people who specifically want to mentor women. Oh, okay, well, this is for us, and I have set up a network waiting to give women opportunities, and here's a woman opportunity coming along. So you have this double thing to encourage. The second one is simply reaching out to groups. What that means is you find, you know, more than one, to give women as an example again, you invite one woman into your editathon or into your hackfest and so on, and then suddenly she's the woman. There's some statistical figure, it's around about 20 or 30% where women stop sort of feeling like the woman. They stop feeling like everything they will do is will be read as, well, she only says that because she's a woman, or she does that because she's a woman, or what's her opinion about women. If you can bring in more than one person at a time by identifying existing groups of diverse people, that reduces that effect. Okay. The final thing is, once you have recruited diverse people, there's this tendency to say, okay, say I identify as a woman Wikipedia editor. I do edit Wikipedia, so, there's a tendency to believe that the two identities are in conflict, that the more I identify as a woman Wikipedia, it becomes like this woman Wikipedia editor. And that the only way to get me to identify as a Wikipedia editor is to discourage my woman identity. Wikipedia editor. Now that's not actually true. Identity is not a zero-sum game like that. It turns out that the more you encourage people to retain parts of their identity that are important to them, in my case being a woman is important to me in that way, enhance my ability to continue identifying as a woman, it also increases my identification as a Wikipedia editor. So you get this kind of false problem sometimes. People will argue that, oh well, you know, having the groups for women or the groups for diverse participants and so on discourages them, like it's an isolationist kind of thing. It actually encourages both identities. So that's a very important principle of diversity too, that you allow people to acknowledge that they are part of a minority within a larger culture, and to embrace being part of a minority within a larger culture. Okay. To conclude my talk, I wanted to just give a couple of specific examples of possible outreach avenues for diversity. Not to say, of course, I've had the pleasure of meeting people over the last week who work with Wikimedia on diversity and outreach to different groups and educational education projects and so on. So not to say that none of this has occurred to anyone in the room, but a couple of examples of ways that outreach can happen. So the first is an example of primarily technological outreach, which I didn't really expect. I talked a little bit to Andy Gunn of the Open Technology Institute, Digital Justice Coalition here in the United States, working with people in Detroit in particular, non-white people who are young, building up communication and access to media and technology. Alright, so their overall mission statement is that people and organizations in Detroit want to believe that communication, that communication is a fundamental human right.
Yeah.
Alright, and then, so this is an excerpt from the principles of digital justice on their webpage. It's quite long. You know, there are about maybe 15 or 20 principles. I recommend having a look at their webpage for all of them. But you'll notice I've just got an excerpt here, equal access to media and technology as producers as well as consumers. Prioritizing the participation of people who've been traditionally excluded. Advancing our ability to tell our own stories, again referring to people who've been traditionally excluded, and the creation of knowledge, tools, and technologies that are free and shared. Now, points 1 and 4 in particular are very compatible with the broader open movement, open access, open knowledge, wish culture, and so on. And points 2 and 3 relate more to diversity concerns. Anyway, so I emailed them. And Andy, what immediately leapt to mind actually was technological outreach, that he sees the problem with, the first problem with getting his community to participate in the media projects is technological. So they're very focused on mesh networking, community neighborhood mesh networking, where you set up, you know, ad hoc wireless networks that have a flaky or not always on, expensive, slow uplink to the internet, and primarily exchange information within your mesh network. And so what he said is, okay, well, in order for Wikipedia to be useful, we would need authentication for locals to use, which of course is possible under the license. Wasn't, in fact, immediately obvious to him how that there was just something that he could actually now download onto their server, and that there are no further obstacles to a local page of Wikipedia, and that all of you could just create one right now. So that's a sort of a form of educational outreach, like having this thing, that it becomes more important to say very explicitly, here's how you engage Wikipedia, here's how you make a copy of Wikipedia for your local community. Not that just that you could if you wanted to, but here it is, bundled up for you, reach out and take it, please. Secondly, he suggested distributed editing. Now, as you have heard, my background is in computer science, so I fully appreciate how difficult distributed editing, resolving all of the conflicts once all the different distributed edits come online. And then you have, 15-way mergers, and I can't imagine what the talk pages look like. It's a very difficult technological problem, but nevertheless, it's something that they listed. Look, our people would want to be able to edit Wikipedia in real time, in their neighborhoods, when they don't have an uplink. I can't tell you how to solve the technological problems involved, but I'm not actually sure whether it's even in theory a computationally tractable problem, but nevertheless, once you ask people, this is something that they say. How can we edit Wikipedia offline? And finally, more broadly, education about Wikipedia and contributing to it so that there would be outreach to their community, to their educators, and their educators would modify the material in order to pass it on to people in their community in a way that works best for people in that community. So in terms of concrete steps, some of them are technological, is the argument I'm making. I think this clicker may have a randomizer in it. When you get pigeons, and that pigeon experiment where you just randomly feed them and they get superstitious. They develop, they think that because they spawn in a software meant for who dropped out that there's some causal connection. There really is no causal connection between me pressing this button and the slide appearing. Okay. The second type of outreach I wanted to talk about quickly, and again, you know, to put it crudely, maybe I don't want to teach the Wikimedia Foundation how to suck eggs. Organizational outreach. So the point I'm trying to make here is that if you're tempted in a, especially in a sort of a individually created project, like a media project, where a lot of people primarily identify as an individual rather than a member of a group contributing, that the responsibility for diversity is evenly spread across every contributor. I mean, everybody ends up with a teeny tiny responsibility towards diversity. Instead, you utilize the groups you have created, including but not only the foundation, and push up to them, look, this is too much work for one person, make a team. All right. So an example I just wanted to quickly talk about who this, the GenderLeaks project is a large non-government organization in Southern Africa, based out, so this is again their statement, they're working to promote gender equity in Southern Africa. Now what they already do, again with the, someone is actually experimenting on me, I think. This kind of problem, this is not unique to Southern Africa, the problem is that when the news media cites sources, even though women comprise 51% of the population in Southern Africa, black women comprise 41% of the population, they appear very, very disproportionately small if people quoted in articles or sources and information that journalists use. And so one of the many projects that GenderLeaks works on is trying to fix this situation, but one of the important things to note, so that this is some of the areas that work in HIV, because there's a lot of reporting on HIV in the media of Southern Africa. Business, the reason they emphasize business is in fact that a great deal of the economy in the region is driven by small women-owned businesses. But when economics writers write about the local economy, it tends to be focused on very large corporations and disproportionately male sources who run very large organizations. Sports reporting, increasing the representation of women's sporting and so on. But an interesting thing, while they do media literature training, as I mentioned here, media literacy training, which improves the ability of people to interact with the media, both, how to talk to the media, how to use the media for your purposes to promote democracy, and how to understand the messages coming in and what the biases might be and what the perfect sources and so on. They also, rather than trying to bring the public to the journalists, do a lot of work on bringing the journalists to the public, a lot of work on reaching out to journalists as the people with the power to change, and journalists and editors, the people with the power to actually change the news media, most directly, educating them on how best to come to the community. So the point with this is that there's a great role for organizational conversations between the media community, not only the foundation, but the community of people involved in the project, and organizations who are accustomed to bringing the powerful to the needs of the powerless, like the GenderLeaks organization, among many other examples. Because ultimately, in the context of this, especially global diversity and economically less privileged people, it's really the media community that has the power that needs to come to the people who cannot reach it, rather than the other way around. Even if you sit there with an open door, you actually need to choose it more as a journey than towards. Okay, so that was some of the specific types of organizational outreach that are effective here are reaching out to cultural preservation groups who are interested in documenting information through culture, and I know that the Wikimedia Foundation has a strong history of reaching out to black communities for precisely this reason. to media literacy and education groups because they're accustomed to bridging communication gaps between relatively powerful writing groups and less powerful people who can't participate in them well. To digital education groups like the Digital Justice Coalition and NGOs and nonprofits in general. All right. So in summary, what I've talked about is essentially an introduction to diversity, arguing that as a project of social change, a project that is at least part of social change, even if it's not an activist project in terms of creating social change outside of the internet, the Wikimedia community has a responsibility to both to its mission and to people out there in the world to always be on a journey towards diversity. And that diversity does not look like bringing everyone inside the tent and getting them to agree that the current way of thinking, the current one cultural tradition or one way of thinking is the best way, but to increase the size of the umbrella, as it were. And I've suggested some specific ways that that can be done.
Time that we got paid to do this kind of advocacy, essentially, and that we raised money as well.
There were, in 2009, and so we had that discussion in 2010. Starting in 2009, there were a lot of discussions in the open source community in particular about the participation of women in open source wasn't just a problem of women's socialization, it wasn't just a problem of the hacker norms maybe being a little more alien to women, but was also a problem of active discrimination against women in the form of, in particular, we focused on sexual harassment in the open source community. So what inspired us ultimately was this realization that there are actually concrete bad things happening to women in some open communities, but also, these are more immediate problems. Fixing the socialization of women is actually quite a hard problem. Convincing people that when women attend a conference that you should not constantly proposition them for sex is actually an easier problem. So in a way, the fact that there was this this immediate problem to be solved. Anyone from this side of the room?
We have a question from Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
I think you are with the question.
Sorry about that. We have a question from Twitter. Why is Pinterest hugely popular with women, but Wikipedia is not as much?
I think that's actually a really bad question for me because I use Wikipedia and I don't use Pinterest. Repeating the question, why is Pinterest hugely popular with women and why is Wikipedia much less popular with women?
Because Pinterest is more pretty.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm the wrong person to answer that question. I'm also not on Facebook. So, I don't know. This is part of the problem, actually, with diversity. You know, if you bring someone like me into Wikipedia, you know, I'm not that diverse in terms of the Wikipedia community. You know, I've nearly finished a PhD in computer science, and I have a strong undergraduate education, so it's all very kind of demographically typical in many ways. And you ask me what women want from Wikipedia, all I can tell you is to keep asking other women who aren't already here. So I apologize to the person on Twitter who asked that question because I'm not best placed to answer it. Back to this side of the room. We've got someone. So if other people would like to have some questions and want to see me during the conference, feel free. And also Valerie, who's not on stage, but she has pink hair. Alright, anyone from the middle? Microphone's coming, sorry. Microphone behind you?
My name is Kristen. Could you say a little more about language revitalization, native and aboriginal languages and the spoken languages as part of diversity?
It's a pretty broad question, and I'm not an academic expert in revitalizing languages. So the typical argument for doing it is that languages, it's referred to as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, and the strong version of it is that language forms thought. So that if you don't have a way of expressing X in your language, you cannot literally cannot think X. No linguists actually believe that. But there is a weaker form, which is that in some ways languages influence thought. A language in combination with a culture makes it easier to continue that culture, to continue its traditions. So that's one aspect. One aspect of cultural diversity is preserving language. Another is the thing I talked about in my talk, which is that encouraging identification with subculture does not necessarily destroy your identification with the surrounding project or group. So if you encourage, if society encourages the preservation of language, preservation of languages, then it strengthens people's identification narrowly with their own culture. It can also increase their sense of ease as a person transitioning in among multiple cultures. The third aspect is that it's just a gesture of goodwill. A lot of very, very hostile political activity in history has taken place to suppress people's use of disfavored languages, Anglo examples, to suppress the languages of the British Isles that are not English, to suppress Irish Gaelic and Scots Gaelic and Welsh. As a gesture of goodwill and apology and humility, allowing people to have their own languages back is a nice first step to some of the horrible repression that has happened of non-dominant cultures in many, many, many nation states. Again, it's a hugely broad question. I've been sort of thought dumped for ages, but I should probably move on. But if you want to come and ask me, I'm guessing there are probably linguists in this audience who know more about language preservation than I do. Somebody for this panel?
What can Wiki...
The one from Twitter. How should Wikipedia change the world? Not that it hasn't already.
How should Wikipedia change the world, and not that it hasn't already? Yeah, so, I guess continuing from my... There are a lot of ways Wikipedia should change the world. I think the preservation of the allowing people to access knowledge in their own language, or a language in which they are most comfortable and allowing the documentation of cultural and historical traditions without fear or favour across across the whole breadth of human experience is pretty damn world changing. So I guess that would be my answer. I think that would be somewhat responsible for that.
Yes, I was wondering, what would you suggest average Wikipedians do to encourage diversity when they're interacting with others? And maybe even if you could talk a little bit about, the ways in which people communicate in a typical ways over Wikipedia, how can those be altered to foster more diversity?
What can a typical Wikipedian do to foster diversity, and then what are ways of communication that can foster diversity in general? I would suggest that a good first step for the average Wikipedian is, I'm not saying that no Wikipedian is already doing this, I'm sure many of you are, a good first